Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to the Creating a Vibrant Life radio show. I'm your host, Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm broadcasting live from Austin, Texas. And we have a very special guest on the line today. And let me just give you a little bit of a rundown of the resources we've provided in this series. The series is all about gluten-free and the effects on your health and on your lifestyle. And we started with, is this just a fad? And Dr. Tom O'Brien joined us for the first two shows and really put to bed the idea that gluten-free is just, you know, the latest and the greatest of the fad diets, and that there's reality to that, that there's science behind that, that there's studies that show the devastating effects that gluten can have on all different systems in your body, and not that it's the cause of all disease, but it can be a contributing factor to a wide range of different ailments and illnesses. And the third show in the series was one that I had recorded a while back, but we replayed because it was so timely, and it was all about how gluten affects your child's brain. And your brain, too, but we specifically focused on children and ADD and autism and the like, and how gluten affects that, and provided practical strategies for that. Last week, my guest, is back today, is Debbie Sipowitz. And Debbie is actually one of my clients who, when I told her that I thought she was gluten intolerant and a lot of her health challenges could be helped by her going on a gluten-free diet, she kind of dug in her heels and wasn't really happy to hear that. And happy to say she has figured out that, yes, indeed, that's true, and has taken out the heels and is really soaring with this and has really found ways to deal with the emotions. And last week, if you haven't listened to last week's show yet, I wholeheartedly recommend that you go back and listen to that show, because Debbie talked about it in a way that I'd not heard talked about before. And it's like a grieving process. And she actually went through those stages of grief that people often do when they lose a loved one, and how she moved through those stages and out the other end. And we talked a lot about dealing with the emotional impact of learning that you need to go gluten-free and how that's going to affect your life and your relationships and your social life and your kids and everything. So this week, Debbie is back again, and we're going to talk about some practical strategies for going gluten-free. Like, how do you get started? What do you do? What do you actually do to make it happen? How do you stick with it? And tips for actually making it easier, because it's not as hard as people think. And after a while, it just becomes natural, especially in today's world where gluten-free is kind of chic and most restaurants and stores are just, you know, jam-packed with gluten-free offerings. So let me tell you a little bit about Debbie before we get started, and then we'll hop right into all of our content for today. And know that all of the shows from the past 4 weeks plus today's will be recorded, or are recorded, the old ones, and this one is being recorded. So the recordings are available at drritamarieradio.com, and you'll see along the right-hand side the archives, and the more recent archives are listed. There's also lots of other shows, and we talk about gluten-free a lot in the other shows, so you're welcome to explore that wealth of information that's out there. So Debbie is a certified holistic health coach. She's also a natural foods coach, and she specializes in helping women to make the transition to a gluten-free life. Her website is hipchicksinmidlife.com. So as you can tell by her website name, she specializes in women in that transition era of their life when so many things are coming to the table and so many challenges are coming, and you know, adding gluten-free onto that is a big challenge, and she's really adept at helping people through that. She has personally had a really amazing history. She experienced cancer, asthma, gluten intolerance, leaky gut, and she's changed her own diet many times over in the last 20 years. So imagine her surprise when I said, well, you know, all these things are great, but you also need to go gluten-free. It's like, another diet change. But she knew that something was up and brewing, because she wasn't feeling as well as she could have. So in her coaching practice, she likes to say she picks off where the change your diet diagnosis leaves off. She helps people get through that tough stuff. And last week we talked about the emotional tough stuff, that really dealing with the emotions and that feeling of loss that happens. And now this week we'll talk about how to actually do it in terms of upgrading your food choices and still enjoy eating, not being dreading every meal and dreading going out to dinner at a restaurant and wondering what you're going to do and can I just cheat this one time? Does it really matter? So, Debbie, I'm so excited to have you back again.
Well, thank you very much. I am thrilled to be here.
Yay, 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 yay. So let's just get right down and dirty. How do you do it? Like, if you were to say to somebody, okay, you have to go gluten-free tomorrow, where would you have them start?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and it's, you know, I always, I guess I like to put things in stages because it's you've got to change some habits, and nothing, no habit changes overnight, right? So there's, you know, there are stages to it, and I kind of see the whole going gluten-free as three stages, really. So I think of the first stage, and people vary in how long they stay in each particular stage, but the first one is just like the substitute stage because, you know, as you mentioned, there are a lot of gluten-free everything's popping up all over the place, so, you know, substitutes for bread, substitutes for pizza, substitutes for pretzels and bagels. I mean, and they're not that great. I mean, some of them, and they're not necessarily, I mean, if you're really used to the gluten, you know, heavy gluten breads, it's your first taste of it's not necessarily going to be, oh, this is great. But you definitely can get used to it. I mean, you definitely can adjust. But I'm saying this is the first stage because it just kind of allows you to hang on to your normal life a little bit longer, right? I mean, while you kind of get used to the new world. So I think of that stage you can eat almost the same way that you did before, just with, you know, some new ingredients. And
one-to-one substitutions, the like.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, eventually you'd want to move beyond that stage. But it's a great place to start. I mean, and it's a great transition. And there are definitely foods that are better than others. But I'm just going to just mention these briefly. Okay, so the second stage to me, because taste matters, and some of that food, I mean, sometimes the bread that you get almost tastes stale before you start. Yeah. I'm saying this as somebody who cooks, because it doesn't have that same, the gluten is what makes it so spongy and bread-like.
Yeah.
But the second stage I think of are, you know, so you kind of realize that the taste needs to be improved, and you can start cooking. I mean, you can start, and by that I mean like with these alternative flours, and there are a lot of flours out there that most of us don't cook with on a regular basis, you know, garbanzo bean flour, teff flour, sorghum, or rice flours, and they don't have the same properties as regular wheat flour, so that's a learning curve too, but still, when you start cooking with coconut flour or something, things actually taste a lot better. It's just like, it's the, you know, it's sort of like homemade gluten-free. And, but it's a second stage, you know, and then the third stage that I see is actually sort of letting go of that pull of flour-based foods altogether and really changing the way you look at your diet. And that's a, you know, I think of it as like moving to another country or something. Like if you move to Tokyo, for example, you can start out being there by eating the same foods you do in this culture. If you started out in the U.S., for example, you know, you could still, if let's say you were eating hamburgers and French fries, you could still do that in Tokyo. I'm pretty sure you could, but it would probably be a lot harder, right? And the more you stay there, the more you live there, you might want to just kind of ease into or adopt that culture or that way of eating, because you'd have a lot easier time doing it right?
Right.
So that's why I think of stage three as really shifting the, your mindset. I mean, shifting the way you eat altogether and having, I think of it like is this 80-20 rule. Right now, a lot of us, we're eating 80% wheat-based foods and 20% whole foods, and you kind of got to make that switch, you know?
Mm-hmm. So, for sure.
The flour-based foods are more like the special occasion, not the everyday 24/7 kind of meals. But in any event, so I think
I like
staging.
I really do, because I am probably guilty of trying to take people right into stage three right away. And a lot of people I work with are coming from a perspective of already having made a lot of good changes, and the gluten, the little bit of gluten that's left is a holdout, and it's easier for them to just go, okay, I'll go get a dehydrator and I'll learn to make foods that are similar but different, and, you know, get away from the flour, because the reality is flour is not good for you in general.
Exactly.
It's not. It's a processed food. It's not a whole food.
And I think that is the great, thing about being in stage three. When you start making that shift, you do feel better, and you do, and that can be your motivator, right?
Right?
So you don't have to work so hard to stick with it, because your body just feels so much better. You have more energy. You've lost the weight. You've got, you don't have the stomach ache. So that's motivating in itself. And then, then it's your brain telling, or your body telling you what to do, not your brain.
Yeah, or that emotional eating habit thing that we get habituated to. Plus, the taste buds open up. Years ago, I would always try to make these gluten-free whole grain cakes for parties and stuff, and they were flour-based. Like, I was trying to use the same old, to create something new that was healthier, and people would take a bite, and they go, oh, yeah, that's okay. But when I started to just move away from that and into using completely new ingredients and making cakes that were made with, you know, fruits and nuts and grains and even vegetables in there, and they had these amazing textures and tastes that were not really that similar to what we were used to, but the taste was so amazing that it's like, oh, I want to learn how to do this.
But I love
how you're moving it in stages, because I find that for some people, just moving all the way to stage three right up front, it's not going to work, and it's going to have them digging in their heels and going from there. So do you want to elaborate on any of these stages? You said you had some foods specifically that were better than others that you wanted to mention in the first stage.
But I do want to just emphasize what you just said, and that is that your taste buds absolutely change. I mean, or they can change once you start, sort of making that stage three shift. And people don't believe me sometimes when I say that. So I just always use that example of milk, because I know for a lot of us, at least for me, I mean, we grew up with milk, and we always drank whole milk. And then at one point, I don't know why, my mom decided to switch to skim milk. And at first, it really tasted like water to us as kids. But it really was a very short amount of time until you got used to it. And then you'd go back and taste the whole milk, and it tasted really funny. I mean, it tasted like cream or something. And that's what you want to get to with your and it's absolutely possible to get to with foods as well. I mean, and you can, I mean, so that like something even like a cookie or a candy bar. I mean, even a candy bar that we, you know, I used to eat regularly as a kid. I just couldn't eat one right now because it would be way too sweet. It just doesn't. My taste buds have changed completely in that regard.
Right.
And I guess I feel like if you know that in the back of your mind, it makes it easier because willpower only gets you so far, and it doesn't doesn't work in terms of making something stick, you know, the willpower. You've kind of got to embody it. And
right.
That's just what I want to say is absolutely, absolutely 100% possible.
Yeah.
And or even just look at different cultures. I mean, how does somebody in Mexico or growing up in Tokyo or growing up in India, how do we all have different, you know, taste buds for something that are so different, or, you know, you can change. But
right. But
anyway, let me see. I just, what was I going to say? Oh, I know for as a, in terms of kids getting, you know, sticking with it, it's, that also is really, really hard. It's really hard to do. And I think part of why it's so hard is because as a culture, we've sort of created this group of foods known as kids' foods. You know, I mean, you see the same menu on practically any restaurant.
Yeah, even ethnic restaurants. Ethnic restaurants here, like a Chinese restaurant here in the States, can have a kids' menu that resembles the same as a steak and potatoes restaurant.
Yeah, right? And they are, and it's all the same. I mean, we can all name the five ingredients before I even go.
You
know, the pizza, the chicken
peanut
nuggets.
Butter and
the
jelly, chicken nuggets, yep.
Uh-huh. The mac and cheese. I know, but, and the thing is, they're all gluten. I mean, they're all full of, I mean, they're all, you know, wheat-based at some, the pasta, the pizza, the, and,
yeah.
So it's like we've trained our kids at this point to, you know, like those foods or expect those foods, and then all of a sudden, bam, we're just, you know, pulling rug
away.
No.
Sorry, we made a mistake. You can't eat these foods anymore. Now you have to eat this.
I know. So it's, I think part of it is, you know, us as adults and the parents, we have to kind of shift our mindset about what kids' food is too in order
to make that
easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that list of foods, I will happily admit, because I started this with my kids when they were little, they haven't ever had those foods as the standard American version of it.
Oh, that's great.
Which is really awesome. So it makes it easier. But even given that my kids had very little gluten, you know, if I got gluten every now and then, we'd get Ezekiel bread or something like that. Going from having gluten to non-gluten for my younger son, who has a sensitivity for sure, was challenging because it was the little things like the soy sauce or the hidden sources of gluten that made a huge difference for us.
Right.
And so I can only imagine what that would be like if my kids were eating the standard American diet.
Right. Right. Yeah, and I think it's because I think that food is just so much more than just something to keep us healthy. I mean,
right.
I think sometimes as health practitioners, or at least for me, I kind of think of it like that. But there's such a huge social aspect to it. I mean, it's a way we connect with each other.
Right.
You know, it's a way of celebrating. So you can't really discount that part of it.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
But I do think, like you said, there are ways to make it easier. And one, as you mentioned earlier, too, is just like to make friends with raw food desserts, because raw food desserts are awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and even now I see it in at least the grocery stores around here. They have little sections of raw food. And so it's a great section to go to because it's you know, by definition, gluten-free. And usually they use alternative sugars and things. But you can get, you know, if you're looking for the convenience of a package of something, they have great little power bars equivalent. And actually, raw food desserts are really easy to make once you kind of get it.
Yeah, people get really intimidated, but really when they realize that they don't have to worry about the oven temperature being just right and sifting and mixing and measuring and all this stuff, and you can throw a raw food dessert together in 5 to 10 minutes versus, you know, an hour or more with a conventional dessert. Yeah, people are really excited when they get to that point.
Yeah. And again, I think you have to get there in stages, and I think that is because they're also great cooking alternatives. Like I have one book that I bought fairly recently that she just uses coconut flour in her baked goods, and it's awesome because, one, you don't have to deal with all these different flours, and you're not mixing the starches, which, of course, when something is just full of potato starch and tapioca starch, that's a lot of it converts to sugar really quickly, and it's not a great alternative. But I'm assuming you're baking goods, you know, as a special treat. But anyway, this book was all coconut flour, and the desserts were really good. And
what's the name of the book?
And I'm just trying. I'm escaping me at the moment. I can't remember.
Okay. Well, maybe you can email me later and we'll pop it up on the site.
Yeah. Yeah, because I actually love her stuff. But, so anyway, and when I'm, let me see what else I was going to say about that. Because I've also made, there are a lot of, when you're cooking with different flours and different ingredients, there's a lot of, I've also made breads with yams or squash or and applesauce and things like that, that it sounds kind of funny, but they just have a really great moist texture, which sometimes in the store-bought breads you kind of lack. A lot of times they tend to be pretty dry.
They kind of taste like cardboard sometimes.
They kind of do, yeah.
Okay.
I know, and I hate to say that because I just, even for me when I started out, I really relied on it. I mean, I'm a label reading junkie. Like I read labels on everything that I buy in that capacity. So even when I first started out and I was reading the label on the back of a package of bread and saw that it was full of rice starch and tapioca starch and full of ingredients that weren't healthy by any stretch, I still wanted it. I still wanted my little veggie burger with a bun. You know, it was
because you were in stage one and you needed it.
And I needed it, and I think that's okay. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think wherever you are, actually, is okay.
So the sticking points. We started to talk about the sticking points. There's so much to cover. We can go around in circles. But what are some of the tricks and tips that you can offer people to how to stick with it?
Well, I think I just really think depending on where you are, you know, if you, like we said last time, I think the information is so important. Like when I think of having trouble sticking with it, I just think of my body healing, and that's just so motivating to me. But the other way to think about it is just to make that mindset shift where you, instead of thinking of everything you can't have, to just start thinking about all the things you can have, because the good news is there are a lot more foods that you can eat than you cannot eat.
Right.
But it's not necessarily the way we've been trained to eat. And I just remember one time also just sitting eating out at a restaurant with my family when right after I found out I was gluten intolerant, and this what happens to be a restaurant we love, and they have the best focaccia on the planet. You know, so they bring this bread basket, and I just remembered that evening because it was really striking to me. I just felt so sad and so depressed by that, like not being able to eat it. And I think you know, it would have been way easy just to say, okay, I'll just start tomorrow because this bread's sitting here and it looks so good. But I just stopped and I focused on, you know, everything. Instead of focusing on that I can't have that, I just focused on everything in this particular restaurant that I could have. And it did change things for me. And I also think, especially when you're eating out, that it's really important to order something. I mean, in this case, I just ordered a bowl of olives or something because I know a lot of people advocate saying don't bring the bread, but I personally love that bread and I wouldn't want to do that to everyone else I was sitting with. But I think it's, you got to eat something.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's usually things that you can eat. And the other thing I would add to that is if you're eating bread in a restaurant, you're not eating a whole food, and that's unhealthy. So even if somebody's not gluten-free, I'm telling them just eat whole foods. If you're going to eat bread, make sure it's whole grain bread versus processed. So we'd already made that before going gluten-free. That decision was already made here that, we're not going to eat bread in a restaurant because it's white. Like my older son, who doesn't follow a strict gluten-free diet, he'll eat gluten-free. He won't eat bread or pasta in a restaurant because he knows it's not whole food and he won't eat it because it's really just kind of empty calories. So that mindset about, this makes it easier for me to say no to the bread in the restaurant because, you know, it's not this just like kind of vague, it's not whole grain and is that really going to hurt me once, to, it will hurt me once because
there's
gluten in it. So it makes it easier to say no.
It makes it way easier. We have to get to that. How old was he when he started?
Born.
Yeah.
Birth.
Yeah, which makes a difference too, right? If you if you're kind of used to it from the get-go.
Right. Right.
Or that's the. But also, you can always think of easy substitutes. There's also a Greek restaurant that I go to that I order hummus, except that now I ask for it if I can get it with carrots and celery instead of the bread, and they're really happy to do that.
Yeah.
And there are, or even a restaurant like Chipotle or something, which is, you know, a Mexican restaurant that's a chain, I believe. But
you can get
the burrito in a bowl instead of in bread. And I know it's not quite the same thing, but I feel like the keeping a gratitude journal is huge in terms of all the things you're grateful for, all the food you can eat, all the food we have access to in this amazing country. And that I do think that helps move it forward a little bit.
I think a lot, actually. Give it the credit that deserves. It really does, because when you actually do this, usually for most people they start to see changes right away. So after eating that burrito in a bowl versus the burrito on the flour tortilla, they walk away and they feel better. Their belly is not bloated, or the energy stays high. Right, substituting a lettuce leaf for the bread in some cases, or the wrap in some cases, makes a huge difference. And they go, I really feel great. I have a hummus on bread lettuce instead of hummus on bread. So it's really a matter of really feeling, really getting into touch with your body and noticing the differences and being grateful for those changes.
Yeah, I was at a conference once where I remember years ago this person on stage saying, you know, don't ever underestimate the power of gratitude. And it was interesting at the time, but she was advocating keeping a gratitude journal, and that's when I started doing it. And I agree with you. I mean, it's an amazing difference. I mean, and it's a very short amount of time before you just start seeing the world differently.
Right.
You start looking at, it's a rainy day, you could complain, or you could look at the gratitude and find the gratitude in it. And it's it's really powerful, especially when you're going through something difficult. And changing your diet can be difficult, but there is light at the end of the tunnel, because once you get to the other side, it becomes so easy. That's, and you just kind of want to get people just past the middle to when you're on the downhill slope, because it just can be so much easier.
Absolutely. Well, we're about to get cut off, and we can. Okay. I think what we'll do is we're going to continue to speak and wrap this up. So if you're listening live, just you'll come back right afterwards, and you can fast forward and listen to the end of it. This is Debbie Sipowicz and Dr. Rita Marie Lascalzo, and we're talking about the transition to gluten-free. So we'll wrap up, and you'll be able to hear the rest of this on the recording. So, yeah, those are really good points, and I think that when you approach the gluten-free from a point of, wow, I'm really grateful for the fact that, hey, I've discovered this, and now I can make changes in my body, and maybe I'll thwart off Alzheimer's and not go down that path like my grandmother or mother or whatever did. And I'm really grateful for all the abundance of whole fresh foods that this has opened up to me that I may not have even started to look at.
Right.
Because I'm so wrapped up in my bread and crackers. Because you mentioned at the beginning, and people may think that's overestimating, that about 80% of the diet is gluten. And when you really look at it from a perspective of somebody who kind of eats a conventional way, it is about 80%. You know, there's
yeah.
the toast and cereal at breakfast, or bagels or muffins or croissants or whatever. And then there's the sandwiches and wraps at lunchtime. And then for dinner, you know, maybe you're having a meat and potatoes meal with bread. Every restaurant serves this big basket of bread. And then there's, of course, dessert. And then in between, whenever you get hungry, what do you reach for? Is a cracker or a cookie or a piece of cake or something like that? So really when you add it up, if 80% of your food, your nutrition, is coming from this processed gluey stuff that gums up your intestines and fogs up your brain, imagine how you would feel if you could let go of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great way of summing it up. And I also, there's part of me, you know, just from kind of a metaphysical perspective, that really thinks this is a message from the universe saying it's time. We've got to go back to basics. And because I can imagine how much healthier we would all be if we could make that switch from 80-20 to 20-80
mm-hmm.
and just have it be really the place where I think it was meant to be, like a treat or just something, I don't know, something that you definitely don't do all the time, but that just, I think our bodies probably could have handled it a lot better if we had stuck with that formula to begin with.
Right, right. It was the inundating it with and altering it and finding out that gluten is this great, makes this great texture, and then genetically modifying or altering it through other ways of breeding plants so that the wheat that we're eating today has so much more gluten and such a different type of gluten
yeah.
that it doesn't resemble even the ancient grains. And when Tom O'Brien was on and he mentioned, you know, we were talking about the difference between the ancient grains like kamut and sprouts, which haven't been hybridized, and how it affects, he said, you know, had you started with those and just
right.
eating them in moderate amounts, your body may not have become sensitive to it. But now it's recognizing even that gluten, which is a little bit different than the modern gluten, your body recognizes as the same family, and will now react to that as well. So a lot of it comes from our food practices and overprocessing the food
yeah.
and, you know, coming to think of food as our comfort versus our sustenance.
Well, it's interesting that yeah. have that doctor, there's a book called Wheat Belly, which I'm sure you've seen, but he, in his book, he really looks at some of those ancient grains, and this Dr. William Davis is gluten sensitive himself, and in the book, he locates one of these ancient grains somewhere, einkorn, I believe it was, but he said it was from someone in Europe who just cultivates this one particular grain. And he did this self-experiment. So he said, you know, he tested it, but he was you know, fully expecting the full, you know, stomach reaction, the whole 4 days, you know, in bed kind of reaction. And he didn't, it didn't affect him at all. And then he tested it against the modern version, and he was in bed for 4 days. And very interesting, very interesting.
Very interesting, yeah. Wow, so there's a lot of resources out there. There's a lot of books on the topic.
Yeah.
If you haven't been to Dr. O'Brien's site and you know, looked at his videos, that's a great place to go, and you can listen to his talks and get that information. This Wheat Belly, that's new. There's constantly new books coming out. Someone recently sent me a recipe guide, and I haven't had a chance to really go through it in detail, but it looked like she was taking and doing really good stuff for that stage one, where she was showing you how to use the flowers and make some things that really tasted similar to what you were, actually stage two, I guess, what you were used to. So there's a lot of resources out there. On my website, drritamarie.com/glutenfree, there's a resource kit to help you. I know that you have a book, a little free recipe guide on your site as well.
Yeah.
And you want to remind people what the site is?
It's hipchicksandmidlife.com, and it's all about just helping women in this midlife transition area, just empowering them to be their healthiest selves yet, so that we can all spend this second half, you know, full of life, full of energy, and your diet definitely plays a big part in that.
Huge part in that. Absolutely. And I know you had a little recipe guide, too, that was gluten-free, some gluten-free raw desserts or something like that.
It's super simple recipes for raw food, but they're gluten-free and they're dairy-free. And if you just go to the website, you can download that. And, that's great.
Great. Any parting words of how to make this easier? Any last tips you want to offer people, like, okay, I'm ready. I've heard these 5 radio shows. You've convinced me I need to do this. How do we make it easier?
I think it's, you know, I really think you just have to recognize that it's not necessarily the easiest thing you've ever done. I mean, so give yourself credit. I mean, be patient with yourself. Don't be hard on yourself, because you know, food is a central part of how we, you know, connect and socialize and keep healthy. So I just take it one step at a time. And I'm just here to say that you absolutely, it is possible, and it is possible not just to do it, but actually enjoy the process. I mean, enjoy the outcome and be so glad looking back at some point in the future that you went through it.
You went through it, yeah. And I will just say, I'm so thrilled to hear you saying that, because probably, what was it, 6 or 8 months ago when we first started working together, I to have been able to see the future and see that you not only embraced it, you're enjoying it and you're teaching others, that would have been really, you know, great for me to have seen back then, because it was like, oh my God, how am I getting, she's really not taking this well. And so if Debbie's made this transition, and you can do it too, you absolutely can. And what she said about it being, it's not easy. And I prefer to look at things, a very old boss when I used to work in the computer industry, he would not let us speak about challenges. He made us speak about opportunities. So when things look hard and it looks like it's a challenge, think of it as an opportunity. Challenge is not an opportunity, not challenge. And the other piece is, everything that's worth having in life seems to have a period of being difficult.
That's
childbirth is one of the most difficult things that could possibly happen to a person. Yet the outcome is so worth it, most of the time anyway. I'm kidding, all the time. Sometimes when they're 2 and 13, you're wondering about that. But it's so worth it. And having a heart attack is really hard. And having Alzheimer's and forgetting your children's names is really hard. And just having joints that hurt all the time is really hard. And those are some of the things that going on a gluten-free diet can actually reverse. And so it might be hard, like the childbirth, but the light at the other end of the tunnel is there, and it's so worth it when you get to the other side.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more.
Great. Well, thank you, Debbie. This has been great. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. Again, Debbie's website is Hip Chicks in Midlife, and go there and download her little recipe guide and explore and see what she has to offer. Go to drritamarie.com/glutenfree and, you know, get a resource kit. I have a really nice little guide that says, here's all the hidden sources of gluten, and here are some, you know, substitutes, and here are some things that you can do instead, and here's some recipes. So between those two things, you'll have, you know, your reading and your work cut out for you for the next few weeks as you move through. And remember with Debbie, the way she put it, I love that, there's three stages. So don't beat yourself up over the head expecting you to be in stage three right from the start. Start with stage one, which is just, okay, just go to the gluten-free section of the supermarket and make the one-to-one substitutions. And once you're comfortable there and you feel like, oh, I still can't eat, move to step two, which is, okay, I'm going to make some of my own because these things aren't as healthy as they could be. And maybe using some of those alternate flours and gluten-free coconut flour. I would love if you remember the name of that, the recipe guide, using coconut flour instead of the grain flours is going to be a huge step up. That where you're still baking stuff. And then the third step would be to just let go of those, that need for having a piece of bread or a wrap that's floury and starchy, and moving towards other things, using lettuce leaves as wraps instead of bread and bread and tortillas, and making raw foods desserts as your substitutes for the sugary, starchy stuff that no longer serves you, and finding that, oh my God, these are easier than I thought, and oh, they're so delicious. And then the gluten, the raw foods kinds of crackers and bread substitutes that you can make when you still want that special occasion treat, using a dehydrator and using vegetables and seeds that are health supporting rather than the grains that can be fluctuating and doing numbers on your blood sugar. So three stages. Feel comfortable with whichever stage you're at. Embrace it. Be grateful that you're there. Be grateful that somebody's opened up this door for you that said, hey, gluten-free, and all the wonderful things that can be on the other side. When you live each day with gratitude and you're just comfortable and happy where you are, looking forward to the next step in your transition, it's going to be much easier. You're going to stick with it long-term. And you know what? You're going to be an evangelist going out there and sharing this with your friends and seeing changes in other people's lives. So, thank you, Debbie, for being here. And thank you all for listening, and I wish you, you know, joy and ease on your gluten-free path. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I wish you well. Bye-bye.